It is true that Walt did not suggest the Pilgrim paradigm, but I think it's fair to say that he was enormously pleased. After the lecture yesterday afternoon, I began to realize why I'm here, because the discussion was about ecumenicity and the unity of the fragmented nature of Christ's body. And I realized that suddenly I was invited because my name was Calvin. Walt, however, was quite disappointed when he discovered that I was a Methodist. And then he was pleased again when he discovered my roots were in the Lutheran tradition. So I am, in a sense, all three, and I suppose that equips me in some sense to represent the ecumenical thrust. I am, of course, enormously pleased to be here with you. I feel privileged to have this opportunity to share this week in your life in this beautiful place. The lectures which I will be giving are tentative in some sense, in that they represent attempts which I'm now making to try to engage our own world in conversation with Paul. I think what was said last evening is correct, in a sense, and in the sense that our own experience, our own world, places questions in our minds which we bring to some extent to ancient texts. And our own experience enables us to see subtleties which maybe heretofore have not been seen. And so this week I plan to look at some of the dimensions of our own experience which I nevertheless feel are faithful to biblical texts and may assist us in our dialogue with the Pauline corpus. The first paradigm, and by paradigm I do not mean a frozen model, but an open-ended model, which has within it the capacity to provoke, to elicit thought, to stimulate imagination, and to be corrected. I think Popper's thesis, which is used quite regularly in physics, that it's easier to disprove a thesis than it is to prove it, may also equally apply to paradigms. But the disprovals of theses are equally as important as those proofs, for they enable one to make corrections in theses and also in our own models with which we work. So I solicit your reactions and questions and discussions as we have opportunity during the week. By Pilgrim paradigm, I would like to make a slight, in the use of the Pilgrim paradigm, I would like to make a slight modification. For normally, I think when we use the term pilgrim, we think of a person on a land journey between two places. I remember that Ernst Käsemann used to say that the life of the Christian is a life which is always unterwegs, that is, on the way, that we are always between the freedom which is given to us in Egypt and the promised land, that our whole life is involved in a pilgrimage or journey between those two possibilities. But the pilgrim image which I would like to use is somewhat more removed from the land journey and more akin to the air journey, or the travel through space in a spaceship or an airplane. And I think in this sense, this model is more appropriate for Paul. For if any here, as I'm sure some are fans of Star Trek or have seen Star Wars or other science fiction productions, you know that you have very little sense of motion in a spaceship, but you always have the feeling that objects are coming toward you and whizzing past you, so that the objects do not appear to be stationary in space. but rather they seem to have a vital activity that impinges very directly on your presence in the space which you occupy. Now, I think that is a much more appropriate image when one uses it to talk about the pilgrim paradigm, especially as it relates, as I plan to relate it in this hour, to eschatology, or to the end expectation or end speculation in the New Testament and in Paul in particular. The uneasiness which we've had with this image throughout our history, and actually within the New Testament itself, it seems to me makes it imperative that we try to rethink this image and try to apply it in a meaningful and significant way to our own experience. Many of you are familiar with the biblical works as well as the great humanitarian efforts which were made by Albert Schweitzer. And one of the things which he did was published after 13 or 14 years in his mission in Africa, a book on Paul, which is called The Mysticism of Paul the Apostle. And in that book, he argued that an essential ingredient in Paul's theology was end expectation, and that there had always been a tendency, at least in liberal theology, to dampen that expectation element, to ignore the tension which is created in Paul's thought by eschatological expectation, by the belief that he was living in the last generation of the world, that his mission was infused with a tremendous amount of energy and urgency, which drove him throughout the Asian world and actually set his horizons into the European world itself. In the sense in which Schweitzer saw that in Paul, he certainly was correct. And many scholars, most scholars since that time, have tried to make some sense out of that dimension in Paul's theology. Ernst Käsemann, of course, called apocalyptic the mother of early Christianity. Bultmann tried to deal with the apocalyptic and eschatological imagery in a very individualistic way, in the sense that he tried to see that the eschatological expectation was generated in the life of each individual believer in the proclamation of the word. You're familiar with that debate and dialogue. And then, of course, more recently, we've had the rather voluminous and expansive works of Jürgen Moltmann, who tried to make sense of this model for our own time in his theology of hope. Now, what I plan to do today is something somewhat different than the contributions that are made by each of those, because it seems to me, at least, they all now have enjoyed the benefit of criticism and have been shown to be both partially correct and partially lacking in the use that they can, or the profitability with which they can be applied to the Pauline materials. Now, it is the case, when you read the Pauline letters, I think, from in all of his undisputed letters, there remains the continuous expectation that the end is just on the horizon of his own life. We see this in 1 Thessalonians already, where there is disenchantment within the congregation itself because the end has not come. And some would argue that there's development in Paul's thought and his later thought, British scholars primarily, in his later thought, he gives up that imminent expectation which he had at the beginning of his ministry. But as one reads Romans rather carefully, which it seems to me certainly is one of the last, if not the last letter that Paul wrote, then one sees that there is also there this intense expectation that he's living on the very edge of history itself. As he says in the Paranetic section, or the ethical exhortation in Romans, the hour of salvation is nearer now than we first believed. That certainly doesn't sound as if Paul has given up on the end of the world itself. Now, within the New Testament itself, we see this expectation and a certain uneasiness with the expectation. It's interesting that Norman Perrin, the University of Chicago, called the Gospel of Mark an apocalyptic gospel. But when one starts looking at the other gospels, one sees modifications of that intense expectation in Mark 13. Matthew wants to hold that expectation, but say the end is coming certainly, but it's unpredictable. But when Luke is written, we have, for the first time in the gospel material, an attempt to discourage speculation about the end itself and try to encourage people to get back into the world and make their contribution there. And of course, by the time we come to the Gospel of John, J.A.T. Robinson notwithstanding, which I think is in the last decade of the first century, the whole application of traditional eschatology there is dramatically changed, as it's focused almost entirely on the individual and how the individual responds to Christ as a present reality. There are some future dimensions in the fourth gospel, but they're so muted that they're almost totally eclipsed by the expectation that the present is the point in which the individual realizes the end which is dawning in the Word which has now become flesh. In later materials in the New Testament, of course, we have other attempts to deal with that issue. And throughout our tortured history as a Christian church, we've had various, this emphasis has enjoyed kind of shifting sands of fate and time, depending on the circumstances which the church has faced. Montanus, of course, called a heretic because of the particular way that he emphasized the end expectation. And then we have, in the Middle Ages, various attempts to set dates and to expect that the end would come on a certain date. And we know Luther's own struggle with the Peasants' Revolt and Thomas Münzer, who felt that the end would come in 1533 in Strasbourg. And we have the Millerites in the 19th century. And then we have Joseph Smith in the late 19th century, in the 20th century, and in our own present time. We have tremendous interest in this phenomenon that comes out of our New Testament history, especially in the what I call kind of sectarian Christian movement of our own time. So I think throughout our history, we've had a kind of tortured relationship to this experience of the end expectation in which is presented in the biblical materials itself. Now, to some extent, the way in which that is played out can be seen in the Pauline letters as he debates with his churches about the importance or the role this expectation should have on the present life and how that should influence behavior. The Corinthians, for example, I think primarily because of their Hellenistic orientation, were absolutely unable to understand how in the Christian life one could both be in and not in the future life, how the future age could both be present and not present. Either, they said, we're totally in the new age or we're not in the new age at all. And so there was in the Corinthian, at least when 1 Corinthians is written, there is in that congregation a tremendous amount of enthusiasm which is generated because that congregation believes that it already totally and completely shares in the wisdom that comes with the new age. And of course, that is the reason for the whole discussion and dispute about speaking with the language of angels or glossolalia, because they believe they already share the life of the angels. That's the reason for the discussion about wisdom. That's the reason for the discussion about the resurrection. They feel they're already resurrected. That's the reason for the discussion about whether or not they really need to be subordinate to the scriptures, as they claim to live above scriptures and even above apostles themselves. And there we have, I think quite clearly, a total experience of eschatological, a claim to total experience of eschatological bliss, which has within it a certain distortion of the Christian life, at least as Paul understood it. And so he seeks, through sarcasm, through gentle admonition, through instruction, through proclamation of the gospel, through reference to statements which they have made and so forth, to correct that over-enthusiasm of the congregation in Corinth. So that is always, of course, it seems to me, a peril. And going with that peril are other expressions that break loose in the community itself. Impatience or intolerance of other members of the congregation who do not disagree with them or do not share their vision, a contempt for those who would teach them, and in some cases, an absence of love, which tends to fracture the body itself and to threaten the very existence of the church. And that's the reason in 12, 13, and 14, Paul has inserted chapter 13 to make love the essential eschatological virtue that transcends and subsumes all of the others, and to which all of the others should be subordinated. There's also within this emphasis on the end in the Pauline community and in other communities as well, the danger of cynicism, which comes from disappointment. And this does not, of course, originate with Paul himself, but is actually a danger that exists in all kinds of eschatological preoccupation. It's interesting to note that after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70, there is within Jewish circles an almost total repudiation of the eschatological idiom. There is in the Pharisaic movement, which comes out of that surviving community, an attempt still to try to understand, appreciate this idiom, but it's almost entirely in terms of future judgment, of future salvation, which awaits for each of us on the other side of the grave. And for those who engage in messianic speculation, or for those who say, lo, he is here, lo, he is there, or for those who want to see the promise as a symbol of Yahweh's coming presence into this world, there is nothing but contempt and disdain within the Pharisaic community itself. Prophets and predictions flourished for a time, and all alike led to disillusionment and despair. We witnessed the destruction of Jerusalem itself and the disappearance of almost all the major parties within Judaism after that destruction. And then what happens to a dream when it's deferred so long? Does it, as the poet says, does it dry up and rot like a raisin in the sun? So similarly, we have the same danger in the Christian community or fascination or preoccupation with the apocalyptic idiom. And that's the reason, I think, that Luke discourages the use of the idiom. But the danger remains of disillusionment, despair, cynicism, and disbelief, and that these will corrode or erode the human spirit, and that in some ways on which the church is dependent for its life. And so there is built within that erosion an absence of any expectation of surprise or expectation of visitation or parousia or a glorious revelation of the presence of God. And so there will set in then, and there does set in actually in some communities, a kind of resignation that is almost like the spirit in so many modern plays or modern movies that one sees in, for example, it's not modern, but still used in a very modern sense, Waiting for Godot, nobody comes, nobody goes, nothing happens. And then there is that rather, I think, rather profound little statement and almost cynical statement in Peanuts, which I dearly love, where Charlie Schulz has, isn't it, Peanuts or Linus, who goes to the pumpkin patch each Halloween and waits there on the eve of All Saints for the arrival of the great pumpkin, and always goes away disappointed and greatly disturbed, suffering from the insults and recrimination of his so-called friends. Now, these kinds of possibilities are negative possibilities, which it seems to me are always wedded with apocalyptic and cause us to take pause when we look at this idiom. There's also the danger for a vicious intolerance, which can divide the community itself. It's interesting that in the Gospel of Matthew, in the parallel to Mark 13, which found Matthew 24 and 25, Matthew is talking about the special tensions that come with the pressures associated with the end of the age. And there he delineates very carefully and faithfully the statements which are made by Mark about that coming end. You know, that there'll be earthquakes and all of those kinds of traditional apocalyptic images about the end. And then Matthew adds to the Markan statement, and the love of man, or the love of the human family, will grow cold. And of course, that's one of the tremendous dangers of that is can be easily associated with the abuse and the misuse of the apocalyptic idiom. The temptation to religious bigotry and self-righteousness and its concomitant self-pity, are those kinds of temptations, are always enormous. And there will always be those within that kind of movement who say that anyone who opposes us actually opposes God. In that kind of context, any kind of compromise is scorned. Any accommodation is impossible. Any kind of effectiveness that requires some kind of give and take is limited to, say, the absolute very least. There is no attempt to really modify the existing structures within the world, because essentially those who have completely opted into the apocalyptic idiom had given up on those structures and have said that they belong to a base and evil world which opposes God. And the sooner we can be rid of them, of course, the better. Now, undeniably, this kind of idiom then can lead to a form of escapism. Now, I'm not saying always that escapism is bad. In some cases, escapism may be a way of retaining our sanity. At least in running, sometimes it's a way of retaining your consciousness. As you try to climb one of these hills around here, I was told by Walt when I came, there's a very flat trail down this direction. Then I discovered yesterday, it's not entirely flat. But what a runner does on those kinds of trails is to disassociate. That is, to think of something very pleasant when you're feeling the pain. And of course, that's a very nice form of escapism. And it's often used in the apocalyptic community to disassociate from a world which is identified with persecution, oppression, ugliness, demonic possibilities, excruciating anger and hurt which is being inflicted on the community. And in that kind of community, it seems to me that escapism can serve a very, very laudable and comforting function. But in many cases, the escapism which is encouraged is not good. But it disassociates us from the responsible role that we have as Christians to play in this world. The escapism may be somewhat Gnostic, as some gospel hymns are, which talk about this world is not my home. I'm just a passer through. If heaven's not my home, dear Lord, what shall I do? Escapism. And that kind of escapism, it seems to me, is not always wholesome and healthy within the apocalyptic community. So what I'm saying is not new to any of you. It's probably an articulation of one of the reasons all of us have a certain uneasiness with this idiom. But nevertheless, it's there in our text. And it's an important part of the New Testament itself. We can hardly read the New Testament, and certainly cannot read Paul, without taking into account the importance and the presence of that idiom. So, we cannot always give up on an idiom or a model because it happens to have within it some difficulties. If there is a possibility that it can be redeemed for us or used in a way that ennobles, that calls, that sends, then of course it is important that we make such an attempt or such an effort. And I might say that any kind of profound art or profound statement always has, it seems to me, within it a certain amount of ambivalence or ambiguity, which allows for the possibility of either enormously healthy constructs or demonic possibilities. But those possibilities actually do not so much inhere in the idiom itself as in the perverse and crooked nature of our own hearts. Now, the difference between the way in which Paul would use this idiom and the way in which we use it reflects a difference in the way he, and I think his New Testament world, views time. We tend to view time with models that sees the future as an extension of the past. And out there is a time waiting for us to enter. This way of constructing time is so much a part of our consciousness, it's almost impossible for us to divorce ourselves from it. We talk about leaving here on Thursday or Friday, that the boat will be there waiting for us when we leave, that time will unroll, and then when we reach the point on which the scroll unrolls, we will board the boat and go away. They're waiting on a kind of static horizon is a future waiting for us to enter it. So we tend to individualize our relationship to time. And time for us becomes, like the hymn says, like an ever-rolling stream that bears all of its sons, and I might add daughters, away. There, in some indefinite time, we enter into God's care. But Paul and much of the New Testament view the future as motion is viewed in the science fiction movies, as time which impinges on us, which flies toward us, which has within it pregnant possibilities, which impinges directly on our space, our life, our decisions, and our ability to witness. Now, certainly that's the way it seems to me that Paul views time, that the future hovers over the present as a cosmic and foreboding reality, heavy, but also tremendously exciting and perhaps awesome prospect. Paul has the feeling that in time there is something that's volitional, that's standing over against one. Do you ever have thunderstorms in this region of the mountains? Well, and I'm only familiar with the Rockies in this sense, but even in our highly secular age, I was once in the Rockies when a great thunderstorm came very suddenly, and then you could see the lightning flashing, hitting the peaks, and suddenly you had the feeling that there was something, some awesome volitional element standing over against you there. Now that's the way Paul views time. Time or the future for him is not a mere unraveling of the past or unrolling of the past, but an advancing encounter which offers these new possibilities. Paul was not unusual in this regard, for this model was widely shared in Jewish apocalyptic and Christian circles. The historical dimensions were not destroyed. But it's interesting that in Paul, the historical dimensions are radically transformed. He still felt that God had acted in history, but the fulcrum of history for Paul is the cross. And this dimension of history is gathered already into the future for Paul, which is now being realized, this awesome element that is impinging on the present. This past dimension assumed a future dimension, as the cross revealed the one who is coming toward us in the parousia, who was already gathered into the future and signaled the beginning of God's new age and offered a glimpse of the character of God who is involved in this future and in this way breaks into our present. So in this sense, Paul shares a vision of the world that is like our own, in the sense that he's tilting against the view that in the Hellenistic world, it was widely believed in this period, that all of one's life was dictated by some kind of fateful powers that predetermined one's destiny, and one's destiny was out of one's hands. He felt or many people in his world felt that they were lived by powers that they could not pretend to understand. There was a There was a kind of awesome fatalism that ran through the whole fabric of existence itself. Now, what Paul is saying that is in the work of Christ, one is breaking free from this fatalism. We are no longer lived by these powers, but a new possibility is offered us. We are still, to some extent, experiencing the awesome hold of those powers which they have upon us, but we also experience a possibility that enables us to lay a claim to freedom. Now, when seen in this way, one should read the dazzling imagery of Christian apocalyptic, the exploding metaphors, the awesome terrors, the earthquakes, the rakia being rolled up, the heavens being rolled up, not as a map of the future, as they often are in present sectarian Christian apocalyptic interpretation, but a way of talking about the pregnant possibilities which are now being realized in God's future, which is soon to open to us. This future is so heavy with possibility that only the highly volatile images will do, offering deliverance, a chance for a new start in a tired world, reaffirming the fabric of love in a context of apocalyptic terror, admonishing the church to look beyond the enormous stresses of a dark and grotesque and agonizing presence into the arriving future. All of these are ways of making affirmations about God, God's future, what God is doing in that future to make himself known to his people. The kind of central question of the book of Revelation is the question that's raised by the martyrs under the throne as they cry out, "How long, O Lord, how long?" It's the question of theodicy. And the book of Revelation is, in a sense, trying to answer that question, not by just giving them a roadmap into the future, but talking about the kind of God there is in the future and the way he responds to their cries of terror and agony and feelings of God-forsakenness. Once viewed in this way, it seems to me, avoid some of the problems which are presented by the literalization of apocalyptic symbol, which have plagued the church from the beginning. The description of who the 666 is in the book of Revelation, trying to make sense out of why Paul thinks he's in the last generation of humankind, and so forth. In an essay which some of you may have read, and I find an enormously stimulating essay, by Hans Jonas, who is, I think, one of the most provocative Jewish philosophers of our time, teaching at the New School for Social Research in New York City, himself a victim of Auschwitz, wrote an article or an essay called "The Concept of God After Auschwitz." This most remarkable man in that essay attempts to deal with the problems created by the Jewish, and I should also add the Christian view that God acts in history, in light of Auschwitz. Jonas concludes that God either, if one goes with the traditional belief that God acts in history, that there must be something wrong with God's character. If God could watch 6.5 million Jews die in the death camps and not do something about those deaths if he could have, then Jonas concludes that God must be some kind of monster. He attempts to deal with this classic problem by restating the nature of God and the way God acts. And he creates what he calls a myth or a statement or story. I don't use myth in a pejorative sense, but in an exciting, enlivening and an imaginative sense, creates a new myth of the creation about the God who starts the brooding process of creation itself, watching it percolate until cells are developed, and then the heightened level of expectation with the God and within the Godhead himself as those cells join with each other and then ultimately produce new forms of life and new combination until there, waiting with bated breath, he sees human life appear. And when human life appears, and there is the volitional possibility within the human context, there is a tremendous and enormous amount of concern within the Godhead himself. For within the Godhead, there is the sudden realization that with this new entry into the experience of the world itself, there comes an enormous destructive possibility, but also an enormous creative option. So the chance waits for that which is undetermined and unpredictable, and at the same time that can produce both new life, exciting possibilities, love, positive statements, and so forth, or can be an entirely negative statement. And in order to allow this human experiment its full potential, according to Jonas, God decides deliberately not to interfere in the experiment. He knows that he's taking a tremendous risk, but he refuses to be a deus ex machina who interferes in the human process and manipulates the strings to get the results that he wants. And in such a case, there is the possibility for the enormous pain that the human family can inflict on itself and others, or even the possibility of its own self-destruction. But Jonas argues in the essay that in order for the experiment to succeed, God has to be willing for it to fail. Children, in order to grow up, have to be allowed to make mistakes. But in this case, he says, God will allow the human family even to make a fatal mistake if necessary in order to see, to allow for the possibility of human growth and self, a full realization of the what it means to be totally human. So this, of course, represents a dramatic change in Judeo-Christian Jewish traditional Jewish explanation of God's relationship to history. I do not ask you especially to agree with Jonas's statement. Perhaps there are many parts of the statement with which you would not agree, and there are parts with which I would not agree as well. But I tell the story nevertheless because I think that there at least is an element of truth in the story which aligns somewhat with Paul's understanding of the way the future impinges on our present. When Paul talks about the incarnation, and that does represent interference in history, of course, he talks about it as a subtle and mysterious possibility, as a possibility that is not placarded on the heavens or cannot be objectively identified, that only can be seen by the eye of faith. For the action there within the history of the human family is very subtle, and the influence that God is exerting there reflects his own hope, and that's the element I want to pull out of Jonas, his own hope for the redemption of the world. Jonas talks about God earnestly yearning for the redemption of mankind, or humankind, with the possibility that if humankind does not redeem, or does not participate in the act of redemption, but ultimately destroys himself, that there will be within God a tremendous ache or pain or cosmic groan that will be a part of the total experience of the cosmos itself. Now, but there is within God this hope for the redemption of the world, for the realization of the wholeness and the fullness and the loving character of the human family. And it is that element, it seems to me, that does accord with the Pauline view of the future. For in the future, it's not just a theology of hope of the church, which Moltmann talks about, but God's own hope, his hope for the world, his hope for the church, his hope for the realization of the fullness of our relationship to the world and with each other in this marvelous world which he has offered us. So Paul differs from Jonas in his assertion that we have already a faint glimpse into that future. Though we now see darkly, we nevertheless see. Though then we will see face to face, now we see somewhat the nature of the mystery of God's hope for the world revealed in this life of Jesus Christ. And this hope of God for the world, which is seen in Paul's understanding of the future, influences the way he views all of his world. Constance and I will need to talk sometime, because I would say that Paul's view of woman in the Undisputed Letters is a very liberated view. That actually it deals with his expectation of certain things which will happen, which influences all of life, including family life, 1 Corinthians 7 and elsewhere. His own ecclesiology, his understanding of his own mission, his understanding of theology, his understanding of soteriology, all of these are profoundly influenced by the tension that's created by this future possibility that is now dawning upon us as the community of faith. He affirms a reality that enables us somehow to realize already in the present what he holds for us in the future. This partial awareness, to be sure, but nevertheless, it is an awareness. In the throughout the Pauline letters, there is this continuing emphasis on partiality, which is related to future expectation. What Paul says is that we know enough of salvation to know that it's good, to know that it offers and provides freedom and liberation, to know what it means to be saved from the powers which hold us in bondage. But we don't know completely. We know in part. In the future, in that future which he's constructing for us, then the more complete version or vision will be realized. It's a little bit like the experience of each one of us individually as we learn something about the nature of freedom and the nature of love. As we know something about love, we know what it is to live a free and unfettered and unthreatened existence. We're able to offer ourselves in risking ways to other people. But we do not know that completely. We know we are free when we're able to do that. But we know it just enough to know how sweet and good it is. We do not know it entirely. And so we aspire for it, and we know that God aspires it for us in that future, according to Paul. It's a little bit like my experience at Duke on Fridays, which was to some extent held in preparation for the meal last night. On Friday at Duke University, we always had clam chowder. And I always went to have clam chowder because I love clam chowder. And the clam chowder in the 3 years I was there was never very good. On every Friday, I usually got a little bit of sand and quite a few potatoes, and occasionally I would get a clam. And when I got a clam, I knew, wow, that's what it would really be like someday. Last night I had mostly clams and no sand, and it was marvelous. Now, in Paul's understanding of salvation, there's something similar to that. We're not always operating with a blank tablet. We're not operating with the absence of empirical experience. We know enough to know something. But we know enough also to know that we don't know everything. To be somewhat modest about our own statements about ourselves and our own Christian life. And this kind of modesty, it seems to me, is the basis for ecumenical dialogue. The future which Paul envisions also expresses, and this is another one of the positive elements in that future, and this is the last point I make before I close. The arriving future judges the present because the message is so deeply engraved on the human heart, which we have been privileged to know, that there is within us a certain amount of discontent with the structure of the existence that we know. With the apocalypsis, or vision of the new age, which appears with clarity, when it appears with clarity, a vision of another world appears which judges this world. It draws a sharp contrast between the heavenly Jerusalem and the city of the human family. Our easy accommodation to prevailing values, to the dominant cultural mores, to the powerful political trends and the cultural biases are illumined in the bright light of another world which impinges on this world. And their deficiencies, the deficiencies of this world becomes clear. The images are compressed into, in some cases, an apocalyptic metaphor, which both describes the outer nightmarish world and also the inner reality of the human trial. Perhaps this metaphor can break through to new freshness and clarity in our world with its heightened awareness of the deficiencies and the impotence of human systems, whether political, political, or moral, or mechanical. The awareness that our sense of progress is illusory, and that the loss of confidence that we control our lives is real, that the apocalyptic viewpoint is not always negative and hopeless and cynical, but makes a positive statement both about the deficiencies of the world which we know and also about the future divine possibility. A statement that's hardly a glib affirmation divorced from the harsh realities, but forged in the ambiguity of the frightening creation and also powerful creative possibility that we know. From a structural point of view, the apocalyptic symbol pulls in two directions. On the one hand, there's a pull from beyond, offering hope beyond catastrophe, and yet at the same time, forcing the hearer onward back into the routine world. The judgment which we hear pronounced on our easy accommodations within our own culture always illumines and calls us to another possibility. Our socialization in some ways is similar to that of the geese in Kierkegaard's, one of Kierkegaard's statements, the wild geese, which, as you know, become accommodated to the farmer's vineyard and hear the call of the wild and are not able to respond to that call because of their easy acculturation to their new world. And the possibility of that is offered in God's hope for us and for the world always challenges, calls, and makes it impossible for us to live in an easy and fat, complacent manner in the farmer's vineyard. So this model, it seems to me, still does challenge and call and disturb, but also comfort and excite and provoke us to rethink our relationship to our world and to our future.